Hello and welcome to the Funds Fanatic Show. I'm joined on the podcast today by Matthew Tillett, who recently jumped ship from Allianz, where he managed portfolios including the Brunner Investment Trust, to join Premier Miton and take over running the firm's $346 million UK Value Opportunities Fund. Matthew, good to see you again. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us so soon into your new role. So you joined Allianz as a graduate in 2006, and you'd been there your entire investment career. What's behind the move?
Yeah, there's a few factors. I think the first thing to say is that, you know, I'm a big believer in this industry that, you know, if you find something that, you know, you're good at and where you can really add value for clients, you should try and focus on that as much as possible. And if you look at my career history and my track record, it's really the UK where I've added the most value. It's also what I really enjoy or love doing. And you know, this was an opportunity. It's a great opportunity. I think it's a really good fund that's got a good pedigree in the market, and I can focus on it 100%.
Yeah,
there's also some aspects to do with Premier Miton itself. Mm. I think it's a really great company. It's got an entrepreneurial culture, attracts a lot of talented people who have got interesting things to say, but also it's collegiate as well, which is not always the case with smaller sort of boutique asset management firms, was very important to me. And that's particularly the case on the UK side as well, which I think is going to be very helpful for me. I've got a lot more UK equity resource here than I ever had at Allianz.
Right.
You know, seven people looking entirely at UK equities, you know, right down the market cap spectrum, which is, you know, very important for my approach. So I think I'm going to be able to leverage it a lot and get a lot out of it to the benefit of the fund.
That's interesting. So despite Allianz Global Investors being a much larger global player, actually there's more UK dedicated resource.
Yeah, from a UK perspective. I mean, Allianz has got, I mean, well, it's got fantastic resource and
yeah,
great investors. But we're talking here about quite a focused, specific fund, which is what I'm going to focus on.
Okay, and well, we're going to get more into it, but 7 weeks into the job, how's it been going so far?
Going really well, yeah. It's been as I hoped it would be, as I described just then.
Yeah.
Settling in well, got the fund where I want it, and didn't need to do a huge amount of turnover, but partly because, you know, a reasonable amount of overlap in terms of investment philosophy and process between myself and my predecessor,
yeah,
which I expected going in, to be honest, which was again another attraction.
Okay, and so yeah, your predecessor, Andrew Jackson, there is, I think he's been staying on for a couple of months.
Yeah, he's still
while he was there. Yeah. I mean, what have you been doing during that time?
Yes, well, so I think the view very, very much was that, you know, I should obviously, you know, transition the
making your own,
yeah, to how I wanted, and I did that, you know, pretty much from day one, as soon as I could, really. So that by kind of early November, I kind of had it where I wanted it. But Andy's very much around and available, particularly from a sort of stock selection perspective. You know, there's quite a few holdings in the fund that, you know, I spent quite a bit of time on looking at during gardening leave.
You know,
some of his ideas that I, you know, didn't own previously, but, you know, wanted to look at anyway, and quite a lot of those I've decided to stick with. And
interesting,
he's been very helpful.
Can you give any, you know, standout examples of those?
Yeah, there's some in the sort of support services space. Companies like Mighty, which is a facilities management company. You know, Galliford Try, which is a construction services company, which I'd not looked at previously, because I kind of reconsidered that sector and sort of did a review of it, and then sort of spoke a lot to Andy about it and met quite a few of the companies again, and I've kind of reassessed and reappraised my you know, the sort of fundamentals and the attractions of that sector, I've got some holdings there that I didn't have previously.
Yeah. Interesting. And you mentioned, you know, the collegiate culture at Premier Miton. So you've been getting to know Gervais Williams and other people like that.
Yep. Definitely getting to know Gervais. Yeah. Who's a really interesting character and a great investor.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, before we come on to the portfolio more specifically, I mean, you, you kind of espouse a value investing philosophy, but you're now running a fund which actually has value in the name. I mean, what's your definition of value investing?
Yeah, I think the short answer is it's about trying to get something for nothing.
Not just something for cheap, something for nothing.
Yeah, effectively, yeah. I mean, I'll explain what I mean by that. It can mean a number of different things. And if you go back to the original sort of literature on value investing and all the various iterations of that over the years, people have interpreted it in different ways. But for me, what it's about is a number of things. It can be about heavily discounted cash flows that are much more resilient than the market thinks they are. It can be about underappreciated asset values or assets that maybe the stock market values in a certain way, but other actors, private market players or trade players may see very differently and value differently. I mean, and actually, it can also be about growth as well, which kind of often surprises people. I like growth a lot. I just don't like to overpay for it. I like to get it for nothing.
Yeah.
Actually, there's quite a lot of ideas around at the moment which would fit that sort of classification, given some of the things that we've seen going on in the markets, particularly in UK equities.
Yeah. And do you start by screening for particular metrics, or is it a slightly different approach?
I do use screens periodically, but I don't have a particular screen that, it doesn't have to be on a PE of under 10 or a price to book of under 1. I don't really see it. I look at kind of every situation differently. I'm more looking for specific types of mispricing, reasons why there's a discrepancy between price and intrinsic value. Yeah. And it's often to do with cycles. It can be, an economic cycle or an industry cycle where, something in the real world has come along. It's, caused a change in the prospects of a business, and the market has overreacted to that created a, opportunity to purchase the assets at a significant discount. Often you have to take a longer time horizon than the market is and than most investors are to take advantage of those situations. But I look for various different types of that sort of mispricing, and then the idea is to blend it together in a portfolio so you can kind of diversify away some of the risks that are correlated across those.
Yeah. And people often talk about catalysts. I mean, particularly I think when you talk about kind of mispriced assets. Is that something you think about a lot? Do you need a kind of specific, light at the end of the tunnel, for want of a better phrase, or are you more happy just to kind of keep the faith?
Well, I think you do need to think about it, but I wouldn't say I'm overly focused on it. Mm. Because it's quite, frankly, quite hard to really sort of predict, exactly when the catalyst is going to come along. So if you take the asset value case, sometimes you can see that there's a clear chance that a company may be taken over because you can see that the valuations in the stock market are very different to valuations elsewhere, and there's accumulate evidence as to sort of why that may realize itself at some point, but you never know exactly when it's going to happen.
Yeah,
you just sort of almost need to trust that you will get some of those. And certainly that's an area that I've tended to get some help from in most years, but it's usually not the companies I expect it to be. It's usually some other companies.
Yeah, interesting. And so we'll quickly mention your strong record on your old UK fund. So Allianz UK listed opportunities, pick out some performance figures here for when you left. 5 years to the end of June, you returned 43% versus 18% for the FTSE All Share. So quite strong outperformance there. I suppose, value investing, there can be some kind of dogmas at play. You mentioned maybe some of your competitors who say we only buy stocks with a PE ratio of under 10 or something like that. I suppose, is there any way your approach has evolved in recent years, or any kind of key lessons?
Yeah, I think one of the main things that has changed for me over the years is I've come to have much more appreciation and respect for things that I don't know, risks that you maybe can't quite understand or quantify, both at a an individual stock level, but also at the portfolio level as well.
Mm.
I mean, I think in truth, I always thought I was looking at that. But I think if I go back to the early years, I probably was a bit naive and certainly didn't know a lot of what I know now. And a lot of it probably just comes with experience, frankly. But it's also led me more to place more emphasis on certainly quality factors to do with resilience of business models and industry analysis and also financial risk. And so one of the reasons that the fund had done quite well even during the sort of early part of that period that you mentioned when value was sort of very much in the doldrums,
yeah,
and out of favor was actually because of the areas that we weren't in and you know, some of the sort of value traps, especially that we avoided.
Yeah.
A lot of my process is actually about trying to make sure I avoid the value traps, because it's one of the big pitfalls and dangers of a value investing approach is that you get sucked into investments that look cheap, but they stay cheap.
Yeah.
And not because there's no catalyst, but because the business itself has got a fundamental problem.
Okay. And where do you think some of those value traps might be at the moment, you know, as you've been reassessing, wherever you're thinking?
Yeah.
Actually, where do you fear to tread?
Well, historically, I mean, examples of those sectors that we'd avoided historically would be things like, you know, the telecom sector would be one, which is an industry which has often been, you know, and today it's also seen very much as a sort of value sector, but, you know, has no pricing power. And you know, despite, you know, all the wondrous things the phone gives us and the, you know, huge amounts of data we all use, they've not been able to really...
Mm.
You know, capitalize on that, and if anything, they're, you know, they've been competing their margins down lower and lower, and so that's sort of why it's not really come through in to the benefit of shareholders. I think quite a lot of the retail sector, you know, I also saw like that. However, I'm much more open minded about the retail sector today. Actually, I think that's an example of one where, you know, there was a major structural problem to do with, you know, obviously online and the overcapacity in bricks and mortar retail. But I think today we've got a situation where there's been a real reset, sort of equalization of the playing field, in the sense that, you know, a lot of the online only companies have, you know, had to sort of find ways to move away from this sort of loss making business model to try and actually make money, as, you know, the markets have sort of reassessed their prospects and, you know, interest rates have gone up, but also the survivors, you know, the companies like, you know, Next, the obvious one in the UK that are still here, and actually many of those are just as good or better at online.
Yeah.
And even the stores are starting, in some ways, are actually, you know, quite useful because they're used as places for that customers can return items.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite different today. So my views do change over time as and when, you know, the industry structures change and the opportunity set changes. Similar thing with the banks industry, which we avoided, you know, basically for the first 10 years of running the fund at Allianz. And it was only shortly into the pandemic that we made our first investments into the bank sector, because we felt that the pressures, certainly from a regulatory and capital perspective, that had been so negative over the previous 10 years had really largely sort of gone away, and that had kind of happened really by 2018-2019, and then the catalyst was, you know, the recession, the COVID recession, which brought all the valuations down to a very, very attractive level, despite the fact that, you know, the balance sheets were in much, much better shape, and so the downside risk was, we just felt, was nowhere near as high as was being implied by the valuations. So, you know, my views do shift as and when things change, but I'm it's quite a bottom-up, fundamentally focused approach.
And I must confess, looking at your old portfolio before and Andy's portfolio, I probably might have mixed them up in my head.
Yeah.
But I remember you were backing a couple of the kind of smaller banks in the UK, maybe more niche lenders.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
something you've continued?
Yeah, that's still the case today, yeah. I think that some of the smaller lenders tend to have they find it easier to find niches within the market where they can make good returns on equity without having to rely on interest rates going up. And I think particularly this year, where we've had this where interest rates have gone up, and most investors wanted to buy the sort of high street banks because they're the obvious beneficiaries of that. And I kind of understand that. And we had some holdings there as well that benefited from that. But that is a very competitive space. And actually there are quite a few sort of smaller niche lenders, companies like, you know, One Savings Bank, Paragon, you know, Close Brothers, some of those we hold now, some of them we held in the previous fund. They all kind of have sort of similarities in the sense that they're able to make good returns on equity, even in kind of almost whatever the interest rate environment is. And that's, to me, a sort of more valuable sort of business franchise.
Yeah.
But they often trade at sort of similarly depressed valuations.
Yeah. And I mean, how much do you think about inflation and interest rates and macro factors like that? Yeah, I'll say you mentioned before we started talking that you were pleased in the transition from one job to another that you'd missed the rather calamitous mini budget.
Yes. September's often a period when I was also during Lehman Brothers. It was the one time during my career when I was completely off the grid. I was up on a hill in Ecuador, and I had no idea what was going on until after I came back from that holiday. So seemed to be quite good at avoiding. macro in general, I obviously you can't really avoid it, but some people, you know, sort of say they don't look at macro, but I think you have to be aware of what's going on, and particularly from a risk perspective, you know, how can different macro scenarios impact, you know, the business models that you're investing in, and the, you know, the balance sheets and the potential sort of damage that can do. But I think in terms of you know, looking for investment ideas and potential mispricing, I'm more of a micro guy. I think you can get more out of the micro analysis of industries. And let me give an example of what one meant by that. So you take the situation at the moment. We're heading into a downturn. We're probably already in recession in the UK. Kind of everybody knows this. You know, it's sort of plastered all over the newspapers every day, and you can see it in the valuations of cyclical companies. What's quite interesting, or I think is very interesting, is when you go through various cyclical industries, the sorts of industries that you would typically expect to do very badly in a recession, what you find is that quite a lot of them are actually operating well below peak levels of capacity and demand. And that's because, yeah, we're still in the shadow of COVID and the impacts that COVID has had. People sort of feel like we're past it, but I don't think we are. I still think it's impacting lots of sub industries in different ways.
For example,
in the industrial sector, the automotive industry, volumes in the automotive industry are still down some sort of 15% plus from the peak that they got to in 2019. I think you have to go back to sort of 2013, 2014 to get to the sort of level that we're at the moment in terms of industry volumes. And that's because the industry's struggling to supply demand. There's very long lead times for anybody that wants to buy a new car. So there isn't really a demand problem. It's a supply problem because they can't get the semiconductors, and they can't, you know, they've had supply chain issues. Now, that's typically been a very cyclical industry. And I'm not saying that demand for cars isn't going to be impacted by a recession. I mean, of course it will. I'm just pointing out that we're not starting from a level that's, you know, what you would typically expect to see at the top of the business cycle, where there's a long way to fall. So that means I think the downside is actually lower than it would normally be, and certainly what is implied by the sort of kind of what would be the sort of simple view.
Yeah.
And there are other areas that are very, you know, more directly impacted by COVID, particularly the travel industry, which has gone for basically 3 years without having a sort of proper period of trading. Even this year, it was sort of impacted by other factors, even though demand did come back. And there's a lot of opportunities, I think, in that industry to find companies that are market leading businesses that are just going to massively benefit from, you know, when the sort of recovery in that industry, and the fact that so many weaker players have dropped off and fallen by the wayside.
Yeah.
And there's quite a few. I mean, I could go on. There's a lot of other examples of this. So,
yeah. Any particular ideas that stand out in those kind of camps?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, industrial company Melrose is an interesting business. I mean, that has both aerospace, which is another example, because the aerospace industry is, you know, had to very much retrenched during the COVID period, and now the platforms are on a multi-year sort of ramp back up to full,
yeah,
you know, full capacity, and they their aerospace businesses is going to benefit from that. And I don't think that's going to stop just because we have a recession next year. Obviously, we also have an automotive business as well. I think in the travel space, some of the market leaders, companies like Jet2, Wizz Air, they've continued to invest in their businesses during the last two or three years, and I think are very well placed to benefit from that in the years to come. And travel, yeah, of course, it's cyclical to some extent. People, consumers, if they lose their jobs or are struggling, they may trade down, they may take a short holiday, but they don't tend, the holidays do tend to still happen. It's not a kind of super cyclical part of the market.
Yeah. And I suppose, coming on to a couple of other sectors, I mean, some quite large positions in resources stocks had paid off for you already while you're at Allianz this year. Is that something you'll
see? Yeah. Well, that's another example, actually, of the sort of micro versus macro discussion we were having earlier, where I found in those sectors that a lot of people tend to look at it from a macro perspective, and including a lot of people who don't like to invest in it, they tend to sort of say, oh, it's just a macro view, it's a call on the copper price or the gas price or the oil price, and that tends to be more of a sort of demand side focus, in that you think about the macro and how that affects the demand, and therefore how the demand will affect the price of the commodity. I've always found in that industry that it's the understanding of the supply side is much more important and much more significant from an investment point of view, because the supply side tends to go on very long cycles, kind of up and down. You get a lot of investment for many, many years, and then you get periods of oversupply and overcapacity, and the investment all drops off. And that's when it gets interesting from an investment point of view, because it takes a very long time to correct periods of underinvestment, which is what we've gone through, I think, over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, both in the energy sector, but also in sort of resources and mining more generally. When you overlay on that the demands of ESG and the energy transition, the demands for some of these, certainly on the commodity side, are actually going to go up rather than down.
Yeah.
It creates a pretty interesting backdrop for investors, I think.
Okay, interesting. I mean, yeah, I think, as you say, people sometimes maybe accuse others of, investors in resources stocks of having a crystal ball and saying they know what's going to happen to oil prices in the next 6 months, yeah, or something.
And
like
I wouldn't but, say I.
But you're saying it's much more about identifying longer trends.
It's long-term, and also understanding the supply side, because the demand tends to be, yes, it goes up and down with the economy, but some things are more cyclical than others. So, copper is obviously more, the demand is more cyclical there than it is for, say, oil, which tends to be more, that goes into sort of more defensive type activities. But the supply is when you get the really big downward and upward moves. And as I say, it's just, the supply crunch that we're seeing happening in the energy industry, I mean, I think was identifiable 2 or 3 years ago. It's just that it's, it takes a while for it to sort of work through.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see something similar happening in some of the other commodity markets as well.
And what do you think about the price cap on Russian oil? Have you paid much attention to that?
Obviously, I'm aware of it. I mean, I think it's quite difficult to actually know exactly how that's going to play out in practice, because, I mean, what's going to go on behind the scenes in terms of sort of what Russia may or may not do to try and get around it? I wouldn't claim to have any more insight on that than...
Fair enough.
Than most people would.
Okay. A big area for you before had been tobacco. You Imperial Brands, British American Tobacco. Has that found a place in the new fund?
No, it hasn't. And I think that was a very good example a couple of years ago of a real stark mispricing that was in part, I think, driven by some of the regulatory changes that happened actually in the sort of asset management industry, the sustainability regulations that came in had a big impact in Europe and actually forced a lot of funds to sell out, basically.
Right, blanket exclusions.
Yeah, either they had to sell out or they couldn't buy any more if they held them, which is not quite as bad, but it also has an impact, because you take a sort of the actual buyer out. So you had this very strange situation where you had sort of one of the most defensive, actually predictable business models, the most profitable business models in the world, trading at sort of 4 or 5 times PE valuations for the UK companies, which, you know, we could buy those streams of cash flows on the assumption that you need to assume that basically there were going to be, nobody was going to be, you know, the whole industry was going to disappear basically within about 7 or 8 years to get to the valuations, which just seemed way too extreme, and was completely out of line with what bond market was saying at the same time about the pricing of the bonds of Imperial Brands and Imperial and British American Tobacco. Today, I think I'm not saying they're overvalued. I just don't. They've done pretty well. They're up sort of 50-70% or so, depending on where you measure it from. But you know, the valuations are nowhere near as low as they were, and you know the volumes are still going down. In fact, the volume declines have accelerated a bit in the recent years. So you know, the pressure is there.
But you're not buying into them for investment reasons rather than worried about, you know, about annoying existing Premier Miton investors?
No, it's not really to do with, it's not that. It's more okay. driven by the way that I value them. I've always been pretty penal in the valuation approach I apply to them, because I do think it's an activity that, you know, I mean, as we said, it's declining and it is going to, I know they've got, they're looking to sort of diversify into, well, they are diversifying into lower risk products, which I think is a good thing. But that's still relatively small. And there's still some question marks around quite how that, you know, what those products will look like in terms of, you know, the size of the market and the profitability in particular.
Yeah. Okay. A kind of last sector that'd be interesting to talk about and ties into a lot of what you've been saying, I think, is house builders, which, you know, you've been a backer of, Andy Jackson's been a backer of, and I'm sure they're in the fund still. I mean, what are the prospects like as the UK housing market, you know, finally starts to cool off?
Yeah, clearly in the short term, the outlook's going to be quite challenging, and I don't think I'm saying anything particularly controversial there, because we can see that there's going to be, there already is some pressure on house prices themselves, and you know, they're still dealing with some cost inflation that's sort of carrying through from this year and probably carry through into next year. So I think you put that together, there's going to be a margin squeeze next year, but again, it's something that's quite well known about, and like a lot of companies in this sort of consumer space in the UK, the market has been quite sort of forward, or at least the analysts have been quite, that's actually something that's changed in the time that from when I left to when I joined, is that the analysts have kind of tried to now get ahead of the curve and sort of downgrade all the forecasts for next year, ahead. Now, I'm not saying with the house builders there isn't more downgrades coming, there may be, because they are very sensitive to you know, where house prices land in the short term. And what my point would be more that I'm not sure the market's really going to value them on the basis of what the earnings per share figure ends up being next year. One of the reasons I've kind of liked the sector historically is because I felt that, well, a couple of reasons. Firstly, I think it's from a structural perspective, I've not had to really worry about the sort of structural issues that were often apparent in some of the other areas of the consumer, like, you know, we'd mentioned retail earlier, banks, and, you know, kind of, there's a lot of areas that had kind of structural with housing. It's sort of the basic product is something that, you know, it's shelter, it's kind of, you know, it's a necessity, and also there is pretty good evidence, I think, that we're undersupplied in this country on housing, given sort of household formation and housing demand. So, you know, that's, and then they're quite easy to value as companies, you know, because you sort of know what you're buying. You know, you're basically buying a stock of land, work in progress. You know, you kind of sort of almost make an assumption about, that stock of land and work in progress and the amount of time it takes to build out the houses, and you can come up with a reasonable estimate for what the actual asset value is of Yeah, and then there's the book value or the tangible NAV, which people look at, but you can also do sort of build out values where you put explicit house price assumptions in to see where you are. And I just think what's being discounted it is a lot more severe than what is likely to happen. A little bit like the situation with the banks in the pandemic, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And then the other factor I just mentioned is that even if I'm wrong, and it is, the house prices do fall by enough to justify where the prices are today and they don't recover, which is an important point that you need to also assume. The big difference today between where we were in the top of the cycle in 2007 is the balance sheets. So pre the financial crisis, this sector, the listed sector, had several billion of debt on the balance sheet. Today, you can reverse the sign. There's several billion of net cash. So they're really, the financial risk is really, I saw maybe one or two of the companies, they don't really have any financial risk. So you're probably not looking at, serious impairment of value here. The risk is that they maybe just sort of don't work in the short term as stocks.
Yeah, and I think you back Redrow, any others, and I guess a quick word on the case for those.
Well, I think given where we are at the moment and what the market is concerned about and where valuations are, I honestly think is that we've got to be realistic. They're probably all going to work or not work together. But I do think there are some differences over the longer term between them. And I generally had a preference for the sort of more mid-cap house builders, because I think that the likes of sort of Bellway, Redrow, they have the benefits that the larger companies have in terms of access to the large sites. And national coverage, which is what you need, and the large land banks, which is what you need to be able to make the good returns on equity. If you're just doing small sites here or there, it's much harder to generate the good returns. But they're small enough that they actually have reasonable growth potential on a medium term view, and that they have new regions that they can go into or new right. outlets they can open, which is less the case for the larger FTSE 100 ones, they've generally been more focused just on sort of generating cash really and returning cash to shareholders, which is fine. But
you can get a bit more growth.
You can, and the market's never really priced this. In many, the big cap ones are usually generally traded at a discount, despite the fact that they actually have this growth. I think it's because investors in the sector have tended to focus more on cash flow now and dividends and buybacks now. Whereas I've sort of tended to see it more from the point of view of, if you're generating a pretty good return on capital employed over the cycle, then, why not reinvest some of that to try and grow?
Yeah. Now, I probably should have asked this one after you outlined your philosophy of what value investing is. But I suppose, as we come towards the end, could you summarise, I suppose, firstly, why UK value stocks in general? And then, why now?
Yeah. Well, I suppose, kind of mentioned earlier kind of the value investing being about sort of trying to get something for nothing. What you find in investing is that the market, Mr. Market, as Benjamin Graham you'd like to call him, at some points in time there isn't that, the opportunity set isn't that great because the market's feeling quite optimistic and things are generally quite highly priced. But then there are other times when there's no shortage of that sort of opportunity, and it tends to be sort of go from one extreme to the other. And the case for UK equities and UK value investing right now is just that there is so much of that sort of long-term opportunity around, and it's basically
because of the low valuations.
It's the low valuations across the board, but also the kind of lack of financial risk. Like you need to take on that many, the risks that you're taking on are not like they were previous, certainly kind of in the time I've done this. You can buy pretty good quality companies, with rock solid balance sheets and good long term prospects at the sorts of valuations that have only really been around in sort of GFC and maybe briefly after sort of the Brexit referendum. They're kind of, really sort of fairly extreme points in time. And it's because, the sentiment's obviously very negative, as we know. time horizons have radically shortened. People are, very concerned about what may happen in the next sort of 3 to 6 months, understandably. But that does tend to also create these sorts of longer term mispricing. And also, I think the technical aspect, I think, is important. The flows,
persistent outflows.
Yeah, and that's particularly impacted the mid and small cap end of the market, because that's generally where the funds that the money has come out of tends to be overweight or more heavily invested in that part of the market.
Right.
So it's created quite a lot of dysfunction and mispricing. And so that's the reason, really. I'm not going to sort of make the case that the outlook for the UK economy is necessarily any better than it is for, Europe or other parts of the world. I think we've got challenges. We clearly we do. But I don't think they're necessarily any worse than many other parts of the world. There may be some areas where they're worse, but there are probably some areas where they're better. We have good. There are good things about this country and this economy and the stock market as well. And I think those things will probably come back into focus again when we get through this period. And there is, people can sort of look beyond the next sort of 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, and well, the FTSE 100 has actually held up relatively well compared to lots of other indices this year, albeit that's been driven by...
Not because of the UK economy.
Well, some of the resources companies we mentioned earlier, which, often active managers tend to underweight a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, what are your thoughts for 2023? Continued UK outperformance?
Well, I think I'm always a bit wary about sort of giving a view on
sort of the broad direction,
broad the market, because it is so... it's 70-80% overseas earnings, and that's the reason why it's done well this year is because a lot of those earnings have come from outside the UK, and they're also sectors, as you say, like resources, which have held up pretty well. I do think, as we discussed, a lot of those areas are still pretty interesting, but I also think quite a lot of the more kind of mid and small cap end of the market, and this my old fund and this fund is heavily weighted towards that end of the market, and quite a lot in the domestic area of the market as well. I think there's a lot of, as we discussed, very, very interesting opportunities at that end of the market, which is more, and that's if I'm right about that, that will manifest itself more in the strong performance of the mid 250 and the FTSE small cap indices rather than the FTSE 100.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how I see it. I'd say I don't tend to sort of spend too long worrying about what the benchmark may or may not do. I just try to put the best ideas in the portfolio and in a sort of sensible way, and just sort of trust that the results will take care of themselves.
Yeah. So it's last quick investment one from me. I mean, when you were running Brunner, you used to invest globally. Are you going to miss investing in global stocks at all?
Yeah, I am. I am going to miss it. Yeah, I am. It was a great experience. Fantastic trust. A really good team managing it, and I think it will continue to do very well. I just the reality is I there's only 24 hours in the day.
Yeah,
and I realized that I was going to have to, as we discussed at the outset, I needed to go back to sort of focusing on the thing that I think I'm good at and I can add value at.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess last question, we're into the portion where, we find out a bit more about what you do outside fund management, but I'm going to selfishly zoom in on something I'm interested in. I've read you're rather interested in chess. Is that right?
Yeah, I do. I'm a keen chess player and an interested amateur. I did play a lot when I was younger. Sort of started when I was about sort of six or seven.
A lot of tournaments and that kind of
thing. Yeah, a lot of tournaments as a junior. I sort of stopped then for quite a long time, then kind of took it up again, and I do sort of still play today. There are some similarities, with investing, sort of how you think about, sort of risk and sort of weighting, kind of when to be offensive and when to be defensive. And the sort of balancing them off, at the same time, and obviously some differences as well. Chess is a perfect information game, whereas investing isn't.
Yeah.
Well, are you a player? Are you?
Well, I used to play quite a lot when I was a kid. Yeah. Not anymore. So I'll we'll spare the listeners to be challenging you there. Great. Well, thanks very much, Matthew. And that's all we got time for, I think. So, yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Brilliant. Thanks. Well, I hope we can speak soon as well. And Last thing to say from me is thanks very much to everyone listening. Please look out for more Funds Fanatic Show podcasts soon and in the new year.